Woodstock is over, and impossible as it seemed to many Americans, close to 500,000 young people lived, laughed, and loved here for nearly 3 days.
Where are you going?
To see if any of those lousy hippies are still around here.
Oh, no, there's no sense starting that up again, Bert.
Freaks! You miserable freaks!
There's someone or something running through the fields.
If you go out there, they're going to kill you.
Where are you going, my dune buggy?
The Werewolf of Woodstock. It's like, how would you sell somebody on The Werewolf of Woodstock? You know what? There's movies that fall into the category of so bad they're good, and then there's movies that just like, you have to see this to believe this. It's not even really a matter of good, bad. It's more a matter of like, this movie exists. I don't know why it exists. I don't know who thought it was a good idea, but I'm glad it exists because you have to watch this. You have to see this just to understand that it exists, because it's such an oddball piece of cinema that was just basically concocted as a made-for-TV movie from like 1974, and it's never been on DVD or Blu-ray, and it probably never will be. It's never been on VHS. In fact, the only reason I think copies of the movie are out there are like almost from like the same vault from which the Roger Corman Fantastic Four movie exists. I mean, somebody got a copy from like a television station. It's the only thing I can figure when you watch the movie, like the print that's out there, because I'm pretty certain this movie only exists somewhere in a vault in Dick Clark's vast archives. Who knows? He might have had it buried with him just to make sure it never fully gets out there again. But it's a 1974 made for television. It was designed to air in late night as part of what was described as ABC's Wide World of Entertainment, which is a weekly rotation of comedy specials, celebrity roasts, Playboy Mansion parties, and bad made for television movies like The Werewolf of Woodstock, the greatest movie ever made about an electric werewolf terrorizing hippies, and then ultimately being defeated by a magic bullet that killed JFK.
That was Scott Foy talking about the obscure TV movie, The Werewolf of Woodstock. Mr. Foy is a writer and reviewer who's penned pieces for such websites as Creature Corner, Ain't It Cool News, and Dread Central, and appears as a co-host on Dinner for Fiends, the Dread Central podcast. In addition, Mr. Foy has had a hand in crafting such sci-fi original movies as Ghost Shark, Atomic Shark, and Starve, and is otherwise known as the Foy Wonder. Foy, thanks so much for being on the show.
Oh, thanks.
This should
be a treat for your fans, because I'm sure they're used to having people come on here and talk about movies that you would actually want to watch.
You know, I was going to mention the the gimmick of this podcast is that I ask on folks who work in horror in some way, you know, writers, directors, actors, authors, and you know, each time after I've asked my guests to be, will inevitably ask which movies have been chosen. You know, all the classics have surely been taken already, right? But you know, we're a relatively new podcast, so we haven't really disappointed too many guests yet. And so far as the movies, though, you know, we've had Robert Wise's classic, you know, chiller, The Haunting. We've had The Exorcist. We've had The Texas Chainsaw Massacre. We've had The Thing, Halloween, Poltergeist. You chose Werewolf of Woodstock.
Well, it was difficult to pick. See, my thing is this. It's like, you have people on here doing, when you told me what the premise of the podcast was, it's like, I can kind of get an idea of what kind of movies people are going to be talking about. And anybody who knows me, I tend to gravitate towards the schlockier bad movies. In fact, I love finding those old gems that most people have never heard of. Because, I mean, when I was deciding, you know, what am I going to talk about on this podcast? I'm like, well, let's see. There's Yeti Giant of the 20th Century, the late 70s Italian King Kong knockoff about the world's tallest Elkridge boy who runs berserk in the city of Toronto. An Italian movie knocking off an American movie set in Toronto, where they land the Yeti on top of the world's tallest hotel in Toronto so that it can then climb down the building to kidnap the girl and run away.
How are we not talking about that movie, too?
Because, well, who knows? There might be more time. I mean, Werewolf of Woodstock's only 66 minutes. There's only so much you could say.
I was amazed at that, too.
Yeah. I mean, I could be talking about Sting of Death, the world's only Jellyfish Man movie from 1966, where they actually... They inflated a plastic bag, put it on some guy's head with a wetsuit with a bunch of beads hanging from it, and then walks and then has him like swim around killing teenagers as they dance to Neil Sedaka music.
I just I gotta ask. You know, it's watching the movie to sort. And thank you for getting me a copy of it. But you know, watching The Werewolf of Woodstock, I was struck by what I had a lot of fun with it. But you know, I didn't even know this movie existed.
Real quick, yeah, you didn't know this movie existed. Yeah, real quick, yeah. When we were talking about this, when you were asking me to do this, and I started rattling off some titles, I could sense from your replies like, I have no idea how the hell I'm ever going to see this. It's like I'm naming off titles, and I can just sense this like, I don't know what that is. I don't know where to find that.
I felt like a bad fan for a bit. I was just like, oh my god, do I not know anything about this genre? How have I never heard of Berserker? How have I never heard of The Werewolf of Woodstock?
I remember that night on Twitter one late night where I commented about I think it was Hard Target 2. Or something like that.
Oh yeah.
You responded to me, and I just started hitting back at you with like, so you've never seen Rolling Vengeance,
which looks amazing.
The vigilante movie where a guy's family gets killed by rednecks, so he decides to build a monster truck that shoots flames and runs them all over. you've never seen King of the Kickboxers, where a guy's brother got killed by an evil kickboxer when he was a kid, and he grows up to be a cop who gets sent over to Thailand, where that evil kickboxer is now taking part in live-action martial arts snuff movies. So he decides he's got to go undercover and get recruited to take part in one of these movies so he can take down the bad guy, and his master plan is to walk into a kickboxing dojo in Thailand and go, I'm an American, and I can kick all your asses. And so they all try to kill him, and he narrowly survives. And they're like, "Hey, you know what? You'd be great for our movies."
I remember you sending me clips of that movie too, that I think were on YouTube, and I was just watching some of them. And I was like, "I can't believe this exists. I can't believe this. Somebody made this."
Yes, I believe in the notion of wabi-sabi, which is the beauty of imperfection. But the weird thing is, a lot of that does not apply to modern movies, because so many of the modern B movies are just so cynically put together, or in some cases, they're just put together without any real imagination. It's like they're too scared to be out there.
And they're not fun at all.
No, they're not as fun because sometimes they take themselves too seriously. Sometimes they're too in on their own joke. And then you watch, you know, a movie like Werewolf of Woodstock, which stars, I mean, Michael Parks.
Yeah, I was stunned to see him in the movie.
Yeah, and at the time he made this, I mean, he wasn't like a giant name actor, but he wasn't a nobody. You just got to wonder, did he do this as a favor to Dick Clark? Did they just give him a briefcase full of money? Did they have blackmail pictures? I mean, how did this work out? Because all he does in the movie is he plays a cop named Detective Moody Silver, who runs around with a Where's Waldo beanie. And if you listen to him, he sounds bored out of his mind the entire production.
To be fair, doesn't he always kind of sound like that? Even when he's great, and I do think he is a great actor, but he always sounds like he could be anywhere else too.
That's true. That is kind of his acting style. But I mean, there's some scenes, you have to understand that this movie, first of all, it's not even shot like a movie. It has the visual shot-on-video look of an old 70s soap opera. It doesn't even have a cinematic element to it.
Yeah, which was kind of surprising, too. It felt like – but you know what? There's something about that that's kind of charming in a way, and I don't know if I can articulate why. But
yeah, it's so unique, and it just – I get the feeling that this was like shot on video on like film, like, say – The Boy Who Cried Werewolf, it might not have been as charming and fun to watch. But to just see this TV movie that looks like a cheap television production, it somehow works in its favor. You know, because like the werewolf himself, somebody just went to a drugstore, bought a werewolf mask, some werewolf hands and werewolf feet, and just put it on an actor and had him run around. I mean, as I once joked about this movie, no expense was spared because there was no expense to begin with.
You know, it is crazy to see Michael Parks running around in this movie, too. But, you know, you look at it. I mean, they had Michael Parks. They also had Belinda Blasky, who would be running afoul of a werewolf a few years later with, you know, The Howling. And, you know, they also had a... like legendary 70s stuntman Bud Cardos playing the werewolf. You know, I was kind of surprised at some of the names that wound up being attached to this, perhaps no more so than Dick Clark, but.
Yeah. Well, the actor who plays the old man who turns into the werewolf is, the captain on the show, The Mod Squad, back in the 60s.
Really? How do you pronounce his name? I looked at it and I was like, is that Tige? Teague?
I don't know. Tige Andrews, Tig Andrews. I'm not Tyga. I don't know. T-Gay. And of course, also, before he actually did anything, one of his first roles, Andrew Stevens, plays a member of the hippie rock band.
Yeah, yeah.
And I mean, and you want to talk about a nothing role.
I mean, I think all of the hippies, save for Becky, you know, those were all kind of thankless roles.
Yeah, you have to explain this. The first thing that's really kind of weird about this movie is that you would think werewolves and hippies would get along. But I don't think there's ever been a movie that involved werewolves and hippies where the werewolves didn't have just absolute disdain for the hippies.
Well, can you say that the werewolf did? Because, like, the human did. Like, Bert hated hippies. But, you know, the werewolf took a shine to Becky pretty quickly.
Well, yeah. Well, horniness will always overpower hatred. So that's just... Okay, you know, I think you have to explain the plot to this movie. So, you know, let me try to explain the plot. The movie came out in 1974. It aired late night on ABC. This is before my time. So, I mean, it's like I didn't discover this movie until like maybe about 15 years ago, when somebody like in the gray market had a copy. Like, okay, I got to see this for myself. And I just like it's always been one of those movies where like anybody I could get to watch it, like you should watch this. And sometimes they come back to me and go, that was amazing. And sometimes they come back to me and go, I don't ever want to watch anything you have ever again. I've had that happen a few times. But it was made in 1974, but it's set in 1969. It's set in the days following the legendary Woodstock concert. And it's just this angry old man, Bert, who lives in the area where the Woodstock. And apparently the stage is still set up and nobody's bothered to pick up the trash, which I guess is another reason why he's pissed off. And he just sits there dressed like a sea captain. He looks like he should be on The Deadliest Catch. And he just starts yelling at his wife, barges out of the house on this dark, stormy night. And one thing about this movie is it's always a stormy night, but there's never any rain. There's always thunder and flashes of lightning, but no water. I guess that was not in the budget. So he storms down to the field and just like starts ripping the place apart, the what's left of the stage, starts ripping it apart with his bare hands and ends up electrocuting himself. And not just like electrocuting himself, like burst into flames electrocution, like he should have been dead. But instead, he wakes up bandaged like a mummy. They didn't even bother taking him to the hospital. He's burned from head to toe, but they're treating it like, you know what, some soup and bed rest in a few days, he'll be fine. But he won't be fine because now whenever there's a thunderstorm, which apparently again is every single night, but it never rains because it's always, you know, ADR thunder, and they use the lighting to try to simulate flashes of lightning. And every time there's like electricity in the air, something in his genetic makeup causes him to become a werewolf. And they actually try to explain this later on with some scientific principle about electricity and mice causing hair to grow, which, okay, fine, but that doesn't explain the snout, the fangs, the claws, the jumping through windows.
Is this the only werewolf movie where the werewolf is created not by a bite, not by witchcraft, but by getting struck by lightning?
I don't know of any others. I mean, this is something even Scooby-Doo would be like, that's just dumb. So now every time there's a thunderstorm, he transforms into a werewolf, rips off his bandages, changes clothes, runs amok killing animals, hippies, cops, pipe-smoking town doctors that gave him bed rest instead of actually sending him to the hospital. I mean, he really takes it out of the doctor. When it comes to the scene where he goes after the doctor, I mean, he Kool-Aid mans his way through the front door and then just starts throwing him through like... They trashed an entire set. That must have been most of the budget right there.
I was going to say, that scene is probably the most impressive in the movie.
But then after he does that, did you ever notice that he always seemed to change clothes?
Yeah.
Whenever he was in bed, and suddenly when he's running, apparently his clothes are also affected by electricity and transform into other clothes.
Well, not only that, the amazing thing was, like, every time he transformed into a werewolf, he's bandaged up like Darkman after he gets burned. He sheds the bandages, turns into a feral werewolf, runs around, kills people, but always winds back up in bed as a man fully bandaged. Like, did the werewolf version of him rebandage his face before he turned back?
You had to wonder, like, does this mean that he had a lot more, like, mental faculties going on as to what he was actually doing? But
well, he was able to drive a dune buggy.
Yeah. Well, the best part is that first time they find him back in bed, he's done up his bandages, but they're terrible. He looks like he's been TP'd by some teenagers. It's just, I mean, he looks like he's fallen victim to some kind of college prank, and his wife doesn't even really seem to be all that suspicious. The next time you see him bandaged up again, they kind of gave you the impression that the doctor had come in and helped rebandage him. We're talking about a movie where the entire production values are slightly higher than that of a school play. Again, no expense was spared because there was no expense to begin with. And then after Bert begins wreaking havoc and the only witness claims to have only been able to identify the killer as having long hair, the police say, you know what, I bet it was that hippie rock band. Because I was about to say our heroes of the movie, but really and truly they're not. They're just kind of there. There's like it looked to me like the band only consisted of two people, maybe three people, only two of which actually matter, and one of which is the girl who I don't think was actually part of the band. Just this hippie chick with a dog that she changes its name based on, I guess, whatever month it is. It's like, well, now he's Pisces, now he's Virgo. if you look at her, it's like she always seems like the whole movie, like she's experiencing some kind of, she's coming down from a bad high. She always seems like she's kind of a little bit out of it because she's been doing some drugs. She claims to have a psychic link to her dog, because the dog is one of the first victims of the werewolf when it runs out into the night.
Yeah, chasing a frisbee, right?
Something like that. They, like, opened the door and, like, threw something out, and the dog ran out. And, like, next thing you know, the werewolf kills the dog. It kills a cop.
And I love later on in the movie when you get to the weird King Kong aspect of the movie when the werewolf kidnaps her and then tries to tie her up. The werewolf, the feral werewolf, kidnaps her and attempts to hogtie her, and she shames him out of it. But the first thing she says, she doesn't scream. She doesn't seem to fear for her life. She just screams at him, "You killed my dog, didn't you?" Like, that's her first order of business, is wondering that.
Well, yeah. For some reason, the werewolf has decided to take a hot. Yeah, it ends up kidnapping the girl, Becky. I was kind of impressed with the kidnapping scene because she faints, and the werewolf just picks her up under his arm. That's a pretty strong guy carrying, because she was not a tiny girl, and just carries her back to, let's say, his lair, but he shouldn't have had a lair. He just found the first abandoned factory in the neighborhood. I guess it would have been really awkward bringing it back to the wife's house. But and then he turns, and like a werewolf turns around, grabs rope, and starts to tie her up. And it's like, werewolves don't. What's even more bizarre than that is the fact that it then leaves her there for what looks like about 2 or 3 days, and she never tries to escape. But to listen to her speak, she can't escape.
Yeah.
which again makes me think she's having some kind of bad trip. She's just. But yeah, she rejects his 50 Shades of Werewolf advances with the rope, but then just stays a willing hostage while he goes back and, like, once again bandages himself up.
Yeah, I don't want to look too closely at it, but what exactly was his plan for her?
I obviously, he hated hippies. He hated acid rock. He hated Woodstock. But, you know, he was an old man and she was a young girl, and that's all it takes sometimes. that's the only. And what's even weirder, though, what's even weirder than that is that at one point, I guess he just starts running out of energy, or I don't know, maybe he just exhausted himself and he almost kind of passes out. And because, you know, I guess with, like, her dog, she sees this hairy, and she starts to escape, and then she turns around and sees this, like, panting monster on its back. And, oh, look, another hairy, wounded animal just like my dog. And she starts, like caressing its brow and, like, wiping sweat off of him. And
does Stockholm work that quickly or with werewolves?
again, I think she was just freaking high as a kite and probably thought that was her dog. That would have been a great twist if she just started calling the dog like started calling the werewolf Capricorn or Sagittarius or something like, and you realize she's so out of it, she thinks her dog has sprouted legs. But the other thing you have to mention here is the other plot going on in this movie are the cops. There's three police officers. There's, I think, Sergeant Marconi, who's like this old Italian cop who, I guess there is so little crime in this particular city, all he does is sit around in the squad room and cook chili. He's got a stove set up. He's cooking constantly. And he's badgering the other cops to, like, hey, check out, how does this taste? How does this taste?
That's actually a line in the movie, too, like trying to explain it away, right? Like, you want some chili? When I get upset, I cook. You know, it's just, yeah, fuck?
Yeah, it almost feels like the weirdest cooking show ever. Like somebody, like Law and Order for the Food Network. Or like the old, like, TBS Dinner with a Movie, only it's like Murder with a Movie. We're going to solve this crime, this string of mass murders that have now begun happening, including the death of a police officer. But while you cops are sitting around trying to figure out, and the two cops he's dealing with aren't even local cops. They're from out of town. They're from California.
That made no, I mean, in a movie, I shouldn't knock it for not making sense because, I mean, you know, consider everything else that happens in the movie. But really, I mean, at what point did the writer decide that two LAPD officers would have been dispatched to Woodstock to just kind of hang out and observe the youth?
Yeah, well the explanation is that they're doing psychological profiles to see if they tried to do a Woodstock-type concert in Southern California, how would they be able to handle it? And, like, it's Southern California. I'm pretty certain they've had their fair share of wild concerts long before Woodstock. So Michael Parks is sitting around there just mostly arguing with the guy over the proper use of oregano, while the girl is doing all the scientific mumbo-jumbo about, you know, thunderstorms and, like, you know, where, you know, this could turn him into a hairy creature. And it's, and the best part is, this is the first hypothesis they come up with. And they're all like, yeah, that sounds about right. It's like, they didn't work through anything else. It's like, that's the looniest ideas. They're like, yep, I think that's very plausible. It's just baffling because, and the whole time they're doing that, the old man is still sitting over there, like, just tending to his pot of chili. And then they
always offering it, always getting rejected. I notice, you know, well, with the exception of Parks offering to help cook with them later, like, you know, he offers them chili and they don't want it. And he just throws it right into the fridge. I mean, that's got a tomato base, you know, it's going to sour almost immediately. I'm sorry. This is where my mind went sometimes while watching the movie. I apologize. But what the hell? It's those weird little details in the movie. I think it kind of adds to the charm in a way. Like, there's something about it that's just so much fun. Because it's so damn strange.
Yeah, look, you know, there's been strange animalistic murders, an old man got electrocuted, there's thunderstorms, and immediately, you know what? This has to be one of those damn electric werewolves on the prowl. and they're all like, you know what? Yep, that's got to be it. Even a Scooby-Doo episode would probably have tossed out a couple of other ideas before they went straight to the electric werewolf. And really, it kind of has the feel of a weird Scooby-Doo vibe. Like, you almost expect at some point at the end, they're going to rip the mask off the werewolf and go, why, it was old man Bert all along.
Well, I mean, the hippie band members do drive around essentially a mystery machine. I mean, it looks like the fucking Scooby-Doo van.
Yeah, and unless I'm mistaken, it sure looks like on one side. It's kind of hard to tell because you only get to see that particular side for a moment. And it's, you know, not the greatest print because obviously this is, like, you know, down several generations because this movie should barely exist as it is. It looks like the face of the werewolf was painted on the side of the van.
Wow, I missed that.
I might have to go back and double check. I mean, it could have been something else, but it almost looks like a lion or even like it might have been like some very, like maybe they used this for promotion. I have no idea.
I'd like to think it was Becky's dog.
Yeah, there you go.
It was the mascot.
But yeah, the van. Yeah, the band is only there because they've got this master plan to record a demo tape on the stage at Woodstock and then try to scam some record producers into, like, believing they were actually performing at Woodstock, so they should be signed.
I love how they immediately let the air out of that plan, though. Like, they even, you know, after they throw out that cockamamie, like, idea, they even discuss, it's like, no, this is not going to work. Like, they're going to see through that, but we're still going to go ahead and do it.
Yeah, but well, look, the greater cockamamie plan is when they actually do get to perform on the stage, because imagine the cops go to them and say, hey, you want to rescue your hippie chick friend? Well, here's our master plan to stop the electric werewolf. We want you to perform on the stage. Play your blasting acid rock as loud as possible, because for some reason that will attract the werewolf, because he hates hippies and he hates that kind of music. Now, meanwhile, we're going to put like two tree branches on top of a bunch of police cars so he'll never see them.
That was the most absurd part. And in a movie full of absurdity, the fact that they tried – one, the fact that they tried to hide large police cars with bare branches – like completely bare, no leaves whatsoever. They just lay one apiece across the cars. That's not even the most insane part. The insane part is it works. It completely camouflages the cars from the werewolf.
But you forgot to mention, like, it's also in the middle of an open field. So if you put two tree branches on the hood of the car, you haven't done anything to disguise that car, because you can still. It's not like it's in the woods. It's not like they're in the there's like three police cars all in the middle of an open field. So based on the female psychologist's mumbo jumbo master plan, the acid rock will attract the werewolf. When the werewolf gets there, the police cars will then like spring from their, surprise, we're not actually bushes, we're actually police cars, come driving up in like a circle around the werewolf and begin blasting their sirens, and the sensory overload will subdue the werewolf. So they can actually, like, you know, take him into custody, because the sergeant wants to save the guy. It's like, hey, this is Bert. I know this guy. You know, he's clearly a victim here. There's something wrong with him. We need to get the doctors to take care of him. But it works. They take down this werewolf. He's like completely overwhelmed. You know, they're gonna take him alive, because poor Bert is the victim here. You know, he's got an ailment and they want to treat him somehow. I mean, that's the sergeant's master plan. We want to take this guy alive. And so, like, what, a quarter, half mile away, whatever it is, he hears this music and he flies into a rage, because he's kind of like a were Archie Bunker. It's like All in the Family, if you think about it. If Archie Bunker was actually a werewolf who just like, oh, those damn hippies, I'm going to charge out of here and I'm going to kill them all. And as he goes to leave, the girl, who is a hostage, even though she could leave at any moment if she wanted to, is like grabbing the werewolf, like, no, don't go. They're going to kill you. I don't want you to get hurt. It's like, I think you said the Stockholm syndrome, or she thinks it's her dog. Who knows? At this point, it's just completely baffling. Even more baffling is the fact that it's broad daylight. There's no thunderstorm. He's a werewolf still.
Yeah, he never changed back.
They stop playing by their own rules. So he goes running out there, and he rushes into the field, and he gets out there, and all of a sudden, yep, here they all come around. The cars, surprise, we aren't bushes after all. We're actually police cars in the middle of a field. They come in on him from like three different directions, triangulate on him. The whole time, Bert Parks is just driving around like Where's Waldo in a military Jeep, which is just baffling unto itself. And they overwhelm the werewolf with the combination of like loud music and police sirens. But it doesn't quite work, because the werewolf comes over, grabs one of the policemen out of the front seat of the car, clearly kills the guy, and then runs off into the woods. At which point, there's a dead cop on the ground, or at least very, very mortally wounded, probably bleeding to death. Who knows? And Bert Parks, Officer Moody and Marconi just have this very calm, casual conversation about, well, that didn't work. We've got to go get him. It's like, they're just casually talking about this. Meanwhile, the female psychologist, you know, she's not even part of this. This is her plan. She's not even there, because she's been assigned to go get silver bullets made for rifles so that they can shoot the werewolf, even though, one, they're supposed to take him alive, and two, it's an electric werewolf, so who says a silver bullet's even going to work? The werewolf now runs back to the silo, barn, whatever it is, to where the girl is, to which he's now relieved. Oh, yeah, the werewolf does get shot in the leg. The werewolf did get shot in the leg during all this. He sells the leg injury for about 5 seconds, and then, like, I guess he healed or forgot about it, and picks up the girl, like, oh, sorry, he didn't pick her up yet. He just grabs her by the arm and starts dragging her with. He's taking her with her wherever he's going. We're actually witnessing, you know, history in the making here. The first ever movie, I believe, where a werewolf is actually going on the lam. He is actually on the run from the police officer as if he were like some petty burglar taking a hostage. And he's dragging her down the hill. And there's some people who just have a dune buggy sitting there. At which point we now get to witness more history made with the first ever werewolf carjacking. Because the werewolf throws the girl into the car. The owner of the car comes running over. The werewolf quite literally bitch slaps the guy, then jumps into the car. And then, to make more history in monster cinema, the first time ever, the monster is the one having trouble starting the car. Because the police start moving in, and the werewolf is behind the wheels of the dune buggy, turning the engine, and says, na-na-na-na-na, desperately trying to get it started. At which point, of course, at the last moment, the engine turns on, he puts it into, you know, gear, and he drives off, and actually, for a second, turns around and shakes his fist at the police defiantly. A defiant claw swipe in the air as he drives off, and now we have an extremely low-speed chase where the dune buggy is going down the road with the girl, with the werewolf behind the wheel, followed by Moody in his Jeep, followed by a police car with Marconi, and then the hippies in their van, I guess, put all their stuff away real fast, and they were going in the wrong direction, but they then make a U-turn and start following as well. Meanwhile, there's still a dead cop out in the middle of the field. You know, I guess they forgot about him. And now the werewolf arrives at the electric plant, where he goes into full King Kong mode and picks the girl up in his arms and starts running up the stairs. And then Moody gets there and takes a rifle and starts going up the stairs. Oh, wait, before he goes up the stairs, we have more history. More history, because this was 1974, and we actually witnessed the birth of Donkey Kong as the giant hairy monster from several levels up with a girl next to him picks up a barrel and starts throwing it down at the guy in the beanie hat who's going to be coming up after him. This happens more than... You almost wonder, did the creators of Donkey Kong watch this movie and go, you know, I got an idea.
I swear, when I was watching the movie, I actually had to stop and make that note that he goes from King Kong to Donkey Kong in the space of like a breath in this movie.
And then Marconi takes out a walkie-talkie with an antenna so long, I thought it was a fishing pole for a moment there. I mean, I realized technology back then wasn't what it is today, but he starts undoing the antenna on this thing, and it's like, it's taller than most little people. That antenna was taller than Peter Dinklage. So now he's radioing Moody, who's running up with a rifle. The hippies show up, and they just get to stand there because there's nothing left for them to do in the movie. They just get to stand there, and there's one more scene where they get to dodge one more barrel, which is really great because the second time he throws the barrel and misses, there's actually pan back up, and you see the werewolf kind of like cock his arm like, damn it, so close. And then goes back to continuing because, you know, that's one of those famous things in movies, like the villain that runs up things, that starts going to a higher level. It's like, where are you going? There's no escape up there. And then the werewolf just completely abandons the girl, just lets her go and keeps going. And then Moody's like, hey, you know, you're going to be okay. And for some reason, leaves the walkie-talkie behind that he's talking to Marconi and continues to chase after the werewolf. And they're like jumping around on pillars and, I mean, not pillars, but like gratings. They're like hopscotching on these things. It's like, it would be a really exciting action scene if it had served any purpose whatsoever, if there was any point to this. And then down to the ground, all of a sudden, the female psychologist comes driving up. Here's the rifle with the silver bullet. What do you mean, silver bullet? Oh, there's only one. It's like, we didn't have that much time. We only got one silver bullet made. And apparently, Marconi is the guy who actually killed JFK, because he fires one shot that in order to kill the werewolf, to hit the werewolf the way it does, would have had to pass through several layers of steel grids, girders, take a couple of right turns, I mean, like, there's no, like, straight shot there. American Sniper couldn't have pulled this off. So as we watch like Michael Parks and the werewolf just kind of like jumping around, almost like that scene from the end of Darkman where they're up on the it's kind of like that. And then the werewolf just gets this one shot, and so you realize at this point the whole ending of the movie has really nothing to do with Michael Parks. You almost kind of realize he you could have left Michael Parks' character out of this movie and it would have made no difference.
Other than jumping, it meant nothing.
Yeah, it would have meant that, like, the old man would have had to go running up the building, and you know, who would have told him to add more oregano? But then they clearly put the werewolf mask and the clothing on top of a very fake dummy. Actually, probably not even a dummy. It looked more like a mannequin, and just tossed it off the side. You only see it for a few seconds because you could tell this thing was about to break apart in midair. And the werewolf's down on the ground, and the guy takes the walkie-talkie and just goes, "Hey, we got him." And that's it. That's literally the ending of the movie. Mark, the police detective who wanted to take the guy alive, shoots and kills the werewolf, who falls to his death, and then the movie immediately ends. There's nothing else to it. The credits start rolling on top of footage of like the guy's face slowly morphing back from werewolf to human.
Was it? Because I couldn't see. I noticed like at the very final frame before it cuts to black, I was like, is he reverting back to human? Is he? Oh, it's cut to black. But was there an effect there? Because I couldn't quite tell. I got to imagine part of that is the fact that this looked like a second or third generation VHS, but
I think it was a combination of, once again, they had no money for special effects. So they were clearly using a very, very cheap special effect. They were just using a very cheap visual where it's like the picture was just kind of fading into very slowly into the original actor. And I got the feeling they couldn't actually get the original actor to pose, so they were just using a shot from him in the bed from earlier. Because he never fully transforms back before it ends. It's a very strange movie that's, when it's over, you're just kind of like, what the hell was that? But I kind of liked it. But I'm not sure why, because it really was terrible. But it was wonderful.
Yeah, and it does have, like, you know, it moves quickly. You know, it has kind of like an energy to it. You know, the film sort of races from scene to scene at time. You know, even when nothing's happening, it feels like the movie has an energy. You know, when Michael Parks and, you know, Mr. Chili are, you know, talking about cooking, I mean, you know, it's only in brief little bursts. And it feels like, you know, even the first 20 minutes of the movie, it feels like everything is either exposition or action. And it just sort of zips along. And I got to imagine part of it, too, is the fact that it's only an hour and 6 minutes long. But, you know, I kind of appreciated that about it, that it wasn't dull at any point.
Yeah, well, I'm at the stage where I think a lot more movies these days should be shorter, especially B-movies, because, you know, it's like even ones that are good, it's like, really, why is everything epic now? It's like, I mean, I think for a perfect example to me, it's like, why is The Conjuring 2 2 hours and 15 minutes? Why is that why is The Conjuring 2 longer than Independence Day 2 or Warcraft or one of these movies? Like, why is it so many? Even like, yeah, I've seen it on like low budget B movies. There was some low, I forget what the title was, but it was just some low budget, you know, TNA slasher movie. And the running time on Amazon VOD was listed as an hour and 54 minutes.
Oh, wow.
It's like, that tells me right there, like, you don't know how to edit. You know, before we began recording this, we were talking about some stuff, and we mentioned, you know, Chopping Mall. Chopping Mall, 74 minutes long. That's a good length.
Especially for that type of story. I mean, you know, I think, you know, if you don't have that much story to tell, then why not cut your movie to the bone?
Yeah, there's no reason for some of these movies. I see a movie all the time that's like, that run on like two and a half hours of like, that movie should have been 95 minutes tops. There is something to be said for brevity, especially when, you know, your movie is about an electric werewolf that attacks hippies and is defeated by acid rock and police sirens.
I got to say, too, you keep saying electric werewolf, and I can't help but think that a better title would have been The Electric Werewolf of Woodstock. That's either a great title for a movie or the great title of, like, a poor Billy band. But, you know, damn it.
Actually, I was going to say it sounds like the greatest book R.L. Stine never wrote.
That would be great, too.
And you know the old saying, even a man who is pure of heart and says his prayers by night can become a wolf when the acid rock blares and the lightning flashes are bright.
I want to see this remake now. Actually, I don't. I can't imagine any remake of this movie would be kind of joyless. You're right. Modern B-movies,
no,
I think, are far too cynical.
But you know what would be awesome, though, would be to actually get this movie released. To actually figure out some way to get it out of Dick Clark's vault and make it so that it's not just this it may be better off that it's like this obscure movie you have to go seek out through some, like, you know, nefarious gray market means, finding some bootleg of it, finding it on, at this point, I think it seems like every B movie is now on YouTube. So I'm sure you can probably find a copy of it there. But the fact that it's almost like an illegitimate copy adds to the mystique of, like, you can't believe this movie exists. Because clearly the fact that it's never been on VHS, DVD, or Blu-ray tells you somebody doesn't want this out there.
You got to wonder, too, how many gems like this, you know, that are so much fun, have sort of just been lost to time because they were never ported over to any sort of physical media.
Yeah, like, for all we know, there may not be a master copy of this thing still in existence. It was clearly not a high priority for anyone, including the people actually making it.
I kind of agree with you, too. It would be fun if people actually had to seek this out. And hopefully the show can play a part in that. I think that would be a lot of fun if people actually try to find the werewolf of Woodstock at this point. But, you know, it's always fun to discover something that you never knew existed, be it on, you know, like somebody recommending it. Like in this case, you know, you passing along a copy so I could check it out. But, you know, or better yet, when you, like, stumble upon it or, you know, sort of excavate it yourself. And I was wondering, would you say that you actively sort of seek out obscure titles like this? And if
oh,
so,
yeah.
Why would you say, what appeals to you about a movie of a certain type like that? And, you know, what would you say makes you a fan of that type of film, like Werewolf of Woodstock, past the point of it just being fun, say?
I write for a horror website, but I've always been more of a monster movie fan than an actual horror fan. So especially, particularly with horror movie, for monster movies, it's something that I like finding, like, these old, just something that's really kind of, like, not that well known, and see if it's actually worth, you know, watching. And in some cases, is it worth writing about to, like, try to get other people to watch it? Because I love, like, introducing people who are like for you. You'd never heard of this movie. You didn't know what you were in for, really. So here's Werewolf of Woodstock, and now it's like I've made another convert.
What was
Yeti Giant of the 20th Century is a movie I've been championing for ages.
We
did a bad film festival down here one time, and I was wanting to run that movie, and finding out what the legal, you know, abyss that the copyright was in. It's like, oh, yes, the copyright for the movie is owned by a company in Rome, but they've been out of business now for like 30 years. It's like, well, who owns the rights to it? We don't know.
You know, at that point, how much trouble could one get in for just going ahead and trying to release the damn thing? Like, one would imagine you would get sued, but I wonder what the maximum amount would be that one could get sued for releasing a movie that they didn't own. Would it be roughly the same amount that they would have paid for the rights anyway?
I have no idea. I went ahead and ran the movie because I figured, like, you know what? If somebody wants to sue me, at least then we'll finally know who owns it.
I think it would almost be worth it in the case of some movies. Like, you know, even, you know, isn't like Fright Night 2, the original one, like caught up in some sort of legal abyss like that? And it's like, yeah, somebody should just go ahead and release the damn thing and, you know, see where all the pieces fall.
Well, somebody actually did release a copy of Yeti Giant of the 20th Century about two, 3 years ago. And it was amazing because it was DVD, but it was a worse print than the bootlegs that I've seen.
Oh, wow.
It looked like somebody got like a 16 millimeter and just projected it on a white screen in their like basement and filmed that and then put it on DVD. It was one of the worst looking prints of a movie I've ever seen get released on DVD.
It does kind of bum me out to think that, you know, even, you know, talking about the title at hand, Werewolf of Woodstock, the fact that there might not be a good copy in existence anymore, that there might not be a master copy, that maybe this is as good as we'll ever get. But then again, at the same time, that kind of takes me back to my childhood. You know, when I was just starting to get into movies, like really loving them, you know, as a teenager in the mid-90s, and with the rise of the internet, I started discovering that there were all of these movies that weren't available in video stores and people didn't always talk about. You know, there was this great kind of a bootleg seller out of, I think it was Cleveland. I mentioned it on an earlier show called Video Junkie. I don't know if you ever heard of them. But they would.
I've heard of them.
They're long since gone now. I mean, I think they started going out in the early aughts when, you know, they. I think they made all of their money, like, doing like VHS dubs of Japanese laser discs of like Argento and Fulci movies, you know. Mm-hmm. But but at the same time, they also release like these really, really bad copies of really obscure movies, or you know, like. Like work prints. I think I bought like a VHS copy of the Halloween 6 producer's cut from them once, you know, and there's something about seeing a movie that you wouldn't otherwise be able to see, even if it's in bad quality, maybe especially because it's in bad quality, that sort of takes me back to being a film fan who liked to dig around and find things that weren't readily available.
Yeah. I mean, you know, like one I mentioned earlier, Sting of Death. I actually got permission from Something Weird Video to run that at that film festival. And that was the movie everybody loved. They loved that one, and they loved another one that I got. Actually, at the time I ran it, I was under the impression it was public domain, and then I found out later that the original company had taken the rights back.
Oh shit!
I was like, oops, but you know, nobody cared. But it's the Mexican Little Red Riding Hood movie. There's a whole series of these insane Mexican Little Red Riding Hood children's musical movies from the '60s.
Writing this down because it sounds insane. Mexican Red Riding Hood movies.
You can find clips from them on YouTube. In fact, I actually uploaded a clip from one of the movies onto my own YouTube channel where you will see a Stinky the Skunk serenading a parrot. Because, K. Gordon Murray was this guy who put out a lot of these Mexican horror movies, European children's movies, Mexican kid movies, and his mascot became this one character, a skunk. It was like his Mickey Mouse, Stinky the Skunk. And he was the sidekick to the big bad wolf. You could never understand half of what he was saying in the English dubs because he sounded like someone speaking a mile a minute after ingesting helium. But, you know, there's a scene where Little Red Riding Hood has a pet parrot, not like a person in a parrot costume, not like a little person in an animal costume the way Stinky is. And Stinky is enamored with this parrot, and you get the sense it's like it in love with the parrot and just shows up at the window and pulls out a ukulele and starts singing a love song to the parrot. And you're just kind of getting worried that, like, what is he going to do to that parrot if he ever gets a hold of it?
And that's a movie that somebody made, and that's incredible.
Yeah. No. They made three of them.
It was
Little
a franchise.
Little Red Riding Hood. Yes, Little Red Riding Hood, Little Red Riding Hood and Her Friends, and Little Red Riding Hood Meets the Monsters. And then they spun off the Big Bad Wolf and Stinky the Skunk into their own movies as well.
So this was a popular series then, even.
Yeah.
That sounds incredible.
Yes, they were popular. The K. Gordon Murray movies have kind of fallen into that legal abyss quagmire as well, so they're not as well known. But a couple of the Mexican horror movies he released have been getting released DVD in the U.S. Like one in particular, I don't know if you've ever seen The Brainiac.
No, but Synapse put that out recently, right?
Yes, that is a wonderfully just loopy, in the best possible way, monster movie where this creature, this man who was being executed during the Spanish, I guess the Mexican branch of the Spanish Inquisition. He's being burned at the stake for his heresy. And while he's at the stake, he somehow has x-ray vision and can see the faces of his inquisitors underneath their black hoods and vows to get revenge against them as a comet is passing overhead, which he somehow magically teleports himself onto right as he goes to burst into flames. And then he returns sometime in the 1960s as literally a rock falls out of the sky. A big papier-mâché rock just goes thunk. And amazingly, it falls right next to a car where one of the ancestors of the Inquisitor is driving by. And now he's back pretending to be some rich baron, and he's going to kill all of the descendants of his inquisitors, who thankfully seem to live within a 20-mile radius of one another. And as he goes to do so, he transforms, for reasons never explained, into this bizarre-looking monster with the hands that are almost kind of like, they're not quite hooves, they're not quite hooks, they're not quite tentacles. You're not quite sure what they are. And then his head looks like it transforms from like handsome Mexican middle-aged man to Toxic Avenger Gene Shalit with a pulsating skull. And a long forked tongue that he can like bobble at the back of your neck for 5 seconds and somehow suck out your brain, but doesn't necessarily eat the brain, because later on he'll go to his special cabinet and open it up and he'll have like a little jar filled with all of these tiny brains. Apparently their brains also shrunk, but they're in perfect condition that I guess he regurgitated back up, and he'll just like take a spoon and just enjoy it like some tapioca.
Where was that scene? Why did they not film the regurgitation and bottling sequence?
I have no idea, but I mean, it's another one. It runs about like, you know, 75 minutes, and it's worth every moment to seek out, because it's just another one of those wonderfully loopy old movies, monster movies, that deserves a lot more love than it gets.
Now, I got to ask, as like an obscure movie archaeologist, where do you start? Where do you look for these movies at, or how do you come across them?
In all honesty, in the beginning, I would be like checking like the gray market, some of those websites that deal, you know, that dealt with like, you know, not the most legal means of getting some of these older films that maybe were released on VHS back in the 80s and are so far out of print, good luck finding a copy. In some cases, they were taped off television. In some cases, they're from foreign, you know, foreign outlets. And the internet played a big part in that. But in a way, that's almost kind of dried up now, because pretty much everything that's to be found has been found. It's pretty much out there now. In fact, a lot of them are, as I said, go to YouTube. Just type in any old movie, and there's a good chance you're going to, unless it was put out by a major studio and they're like, you know, yanking it off YouTube the moment somebody puts it up, you'll find it. There's really not that many that are impossible to find nowadays. I think I have one in particular. It's not a horror movie. It's called Hammerhead Jones.
What is this?
It's a very obscure pro wrestling movie from the 1985-86, starring Ted Vernon, who was the guy from, he was in the movies like Scarecrows. Remember that old 80s horror movie?
Yeah.
The bald guy with the beard, where he plays basically a Hulk Hogan level wrestler who with some of the worst fashion sense known to man. and the plot of the movie is almost identical to the Hulk Hogan movie, No Holds Barred.
Oh my God, I remember that.
Except this came out before.
Really? The Hulk Hogan like, Tiny Lister movie was a ripoff of Hammerhead Jones?
It almost seems that way. I would love to know the story behind that, because this movie is dated at least a year before Over the Top. I'm sorry, not Over the Top. I'm sorry, No Holds Barred. But it has almost the same identical promo of the promoter trying to screw over the champion with his new monstrous heel villain who was... oh God, what was the guy? He had the stupidest name. It was like something like Altraz, the Prince of Darkness. They keep hyping this guy under this hood. And then when they finally rip the hood off with a big match at the end of the movie, and you get to see what this guy looks like, it's like, he just looks like Bluto from Popeye with some eye makeup on to make him look demonic. And
This sounds like a must watch too.
Yeah. It's like I actually managed to find a copy of this, because apparently a PAL copy in Britain is like one of the only places it ever got released. So another movie that we could have talked about on this show that I decided to pass on in favor of Werewolf of Woodstock was Elves.
What
have
is
you ever
Elves?
Seen Elves is a direct-to-video horror movie from about, I don't know, what, 95? Maybe, actually, you know, I think about 90.
Wait a second. Yes, I am aware of this. I think Fangoria either read an ad or ran a piece on it once way back in the day.
Yes, it's the movie where Dan Haggerty plays an ex-cop turned department store Santa who has to save a virgin girl from a neo-Nazi elf that has been brought to life.
I have seen this movie. You're not going to believe this. I think I want to believe that a substitute teacher, allowed my class to watch it, part of it, during nearing the Christmas break or whatever, and realized it wasn't a family Christmas film and had to stop it like 15 or 20 minutes in. I do remember this movie.
Oh, for gosh. So in other words, another idiot who from the I took my child to see Bad Santa, not realizing what I was getting into.
Pretty much. My God, I had forgotten about that movie, but yeah, I know that. Well, I know the first 20 minutes of that film.
Yeah, I actually did something. I used to have a massive. I still have a massive VHS collection, but it's kind of like it packed away. But I dubbed as much of it as possible to my DVD for posterity's sake. And it's just like I go through there sometimes. It's like there's stuff in there. It's like I've dubbed this. I own this. I've never watched this. So I haven't even discovered everything in my own collection, which is kind of sad, really, when you think about it. Just sad and depressing.
Hey, no, I look at that as fun. Think about the movies you still have to discover.
Yeah, I used to have the phrase on my website, one man, many movies, no life.
Now, can I ask, how long have you been writing for, various genre sites? Because I remember, back when I was a teenager, I started getting into, just checking out different horror sites, not even horror sites. I remember my go-tos back in the day when I was still a teenager in the late 90s. God, that feels like so long ago now. But, I would go to Ain't It Cool and Dark Horizons, and, I was part of this site called horrormovies.com for a while. But I remember seeing your name starting to recur several times, like when I would hit Ain't It Cool or Creature Corner back in the day.
That was early 2000s is when it began.
Very cool. Now, I might have this wrong, but I remember being a huge fan of Creature Corner. And was it Creature Corner that sort of morphed into Dread Central, or am I getting that wrong?
Yeah. No, Creature Corner broke off and became Dread Central.
Okay. All right. And you stuck with them through that transition. Does Creature Corner still exist? Like, I wanted to believe that Creature Corner continued to exist after Dread Central went up, but I think they've sort of well and truly gone away at this point, haven't they?
I think it did stick around for a little while as a subsidiary of Chud, but Chud.com, but I think it might still be around, but if it is, it's a shadow of what it once was.
That's too bad. That used to be my absolute favorite site. So can I ask, what was, you started writing in the early aughts, then around that time. How long would you say you've been a huge movie fan? Like, what was the first movie that you saw that you would say made you a film fan? Or, which film would you say that you saw that made you a fan of sort of more obscure oddities like The Werewolf of Woodstock?
In the case of the oddities, I think Mystery Science Theater 3000. I was a fan of that show when I was much younger, and most of the stuff they had on there were these oddities, these weird movies that the kind of films that would only usually show up on cable and late nights, and in some cases, look, Manos: The Hands of Fate came out on Blu-ray recently, and I just remember when I wrote about that why would you watch that movie without Mystery Science Theater 3000 at the bottom of the screen?
So you're telling me that I bought the Blu-ray for no reason. I just purchased it at a recent convention from the Synapse guys, who promised me that the movie's a blast.
It is true. I guess. That's one of those movies where nobody would know about that movie if it wasn't for MST3K. I don't know. There are some movies that are just bad. I mean, even though that one does have a quirky quality to it, to me, that one's just kind of boring. But there's a reason why it's considered one of the worst movies ever made.
So it's not even like one of the worst movies ever made, but fun in the way an Ed Wood movie can be.
Yeah, it has some fun moments in it, but I'm not really a big fan of that movie on its own, put it that way.
You know, I just read somewhere where apparently there is going to be a sequel with some of the original participants in it.
I think I wrote about that a couple years ago.
Oh.
We'll see when it happens. That's like, you know, Hobgoblins is coming out on Blu-ray in a special edition. And I'm just like, again, without MST3K. It's like, growing up as a kid, I used to watch all the, all sorts of like old Godzilla movies, Creature from the Black Lagoon, stuff like that. And then, of course, the mainstream stuff that you would, expect. So I can't really say like, oh, when did you become a fan of cinema in general, but the oddity kind of stuff, that's where, even my writing began. It's like, let me write about the weird movies, the odd movies, but unfortunately most of what I ended up watching weren't even fun bad. I ended up just watching movies that were just abysmal. Just movies that made you question, like, why did I spend money doing that? Why did I waste hours and even writing about it? So I would be like, you know what? Here's my mentality. I'm watching this movie hoping that I'm going to see something that's actually enjoyable, whether it's actually legitimately good or so bad it's good, either or. And if it's not, hopefully I can at least pen an enjoyable review.
And now, what sometimes would you say?
Sometimes those reviews were funny, sometimes they were scathing, but it's like, that's kind of where my mentality was. It almost like, if nothing else, this review might hopefully will become kind of like a Mystery Science Theater 3000 in print version of the movie, because I lost track of the number of times where I'd write a positive review and get no feedback. I'd watch something that had no redeeming values and just say, like, this is just garbage of the worst, just absolutely terrible. And that's the one I'd always hear from somebody going, I got to see this. And I'd be like, no, you don't have to see this. You don't actually have to, like, no, I got to see this. Like, okay, fine, go ahead.
Hey, I have read many of your reviews, sir. I'm a fan. And I will say that your scathing reviews are typically the funniest. Like, you sent me that recent Highlander. Well, not the recent. You sent me recently the Highlander, the Source review, which is just, it's everything that movie deserves.
Yeah. I actually had one of the first reviews of that movie anywhere online, and I'm still convinced to this day that the producers read it. Originally it was released in Russia on DVD. It was a Russian release originally before it came anywhere else in the world. And the producers were like, well, the cut that's out in Russia, that's not going to be the cut you're going to see in America.
Yes.
And I still,
a friend of mine actually told me that same thing. He, God, do you remember back when Highlander used to be a huge thing? I mean, it wasn't even that long ago. It might have been, say within like the last 10 years, but a buddy of mine was such a big Highlander fan. He would get those magazines that where you could buy like the Connor McLeod sword for $300 or,
yep,
the Duncan McLeod fingertip length leather jacket for God knows how much. And
actually, on my YouTube channel, I actually found one of the old commercials that were for like the Highlander fan club collector's catalog.
He actually got I don't know if he called them or they called him for some reason, to renew the mag or check on an address or something, but he actually asked them about that movie or maybe they mentioned that it was coming up or whatever. Keep an eye out for it. And he's like, look, I've read the reviews. I'm not interested in it. And they're like, no. That was the original Russian cut. That's just something we had to rush out over there. But no, when it comes to America, it's going to be something. It's going to be amazing. And I remember, he told me that, and I will admit this freely. I am kind of a huge Highlander fan. I'm a sucker for that series. There's one good movie, and I love it so much that it's fooled me for what? Four sequels? Five sequels?
What gets me is that you're like, well, we promise you it's going to be, the American, then the other cut's going to be better. And it's like, haven't they spent like almost 25 years trying to do the same thing with Highlander 2, The Quickening? Here's, it's Highlander 2, The Quickening. Oh, but here's the Renegade version. Here's the director's cut. Here's the restored director's cut. It's like they're just determined to convince us that, no, that was really going to be a good movie. It just, unfortunately, there was financial issues. Like, there was more than financial issues.
They just, yeah. Oh my God. The
and the Source, from having seen the U.S. version and the Russian, it's like there are slight differences.
Is that it? Because I remember being suckered into it, like, Hope Springs Eternal with that fucking franchise. I bought that damn DVD when it came out, and I popped it in, and I kept my fingers crossed. And 10 minutes in, I was like, oh God. Oh, no.
Minor differences towards the end, yeah. But yeah, that's how dedicated my craft I was. I would actually spend the money to go get these foreign DVDs, and I was hoping for the best, and then ended up like, oh nope, not Highlander the Source. That one was so bad, they got so cheap they wouldn't even pay Queen for their music anymore. Instead, had bad cover versions.
Oh, that cover version, the slow motion, and the moment that song kicks in, I was like, are they really doing this? Are they doing this to us right now, fans? Do they hate us so much? And why could they never get the damn villain right? Ever. Like, the Kurgan was great, and then every villain after that was somebody trying to be Clancy Brown and failing miserably.
Well, not only that would they try to be Clancy Brown, but most of the time they would also suddenly erupt into pop culture references that they shouldn't know. Because, you know, depending on which version of Highlander 2 The Quickening, Michael Ironside is either from another planet or the distant past. He should not be saying, that's no way to treat your number one draft choice.
Yeah. Oh, God, yeah.
Just like in that movie, you know, they teleport, you know, Ramirez from, you know, dying in, what, the 14th century, 15th, 16th century to futuristic times. And he immediately knows what an airplane is and how to go get an airport, go to the airport and get a ticket and fly over to find McCloud, and then and use phrases like "punch it, McCloud." you know, the villain in the Source is the immortal Antichrist who's been locked up in a nether region for, you know, millennia, and he's like, "Thank you, everyone. Thank you, your glory audience. Good night, everyone."
Oh, it's just awful. The villain was the worst in a franchise full of terrible villains. The guy in the Source was the worst.
It's really amazing when you think about it. In the course of this one podcast, we've now discussed the Werewolf of Woodstock, the Brainiac, Yeti Giant of the 20th century, Elves, Sting of Death, Highlander movies.
That's how we do it at Scream Addicts. We, you know, the conversation goes where it wants.
That's like I was going to say, but, you know, Mario Van Peebles. There's one thing about the only thing about the Final Dimension I still remember that always baffled me about that movie is he and two other immortals are locked inside this cave, and that's how they missed out on the gathering. That's the little trick to get out of that thing. So when it finally they finally look at each other and go, you know what, we've been trapped in this place for hundreds of years. How about I just chop one of your heads off, cause a quickening, and that'll blast us out of the cave. So he does that. He chops both their heads off, and they get out. It's like, you would have figured he would have done that, I don't know, a couple hundred years prior. I just try to imagine, what was it like for them just sitting in that cave with nothing, no food, nothing to do, sitting around, just completely bored, and then finally one day, like, hey, I got an idea. And then, as soon as he does that, how do they get him over to New York City to fight Connor McCloud? He just teleports over there. So what stopped him from teleporting out of the cave?
Yeah, I know. And, you know, the thing about the third one, too, is that, like, it immediately – you get to the end of the first Highlander, and for horror fans out there listening to this, if you don't dig Highlander, I apologize for this weird tangent. But, you know, honestly, you should like Highlander, at least the first one, enough to bear this conversation. But anyway, you know, you get to the end of the first Highlander, and you are told there can be only one, and he's the one, and that's it. And then the second one retcons that. But then you get to the third one, and the third one wipes the second out of existence. And then you get to the television show, and it does away with everything. It all goes back to the first movie. Can you think of another franchise where none of the sequels connect? I mean, maybe The Source and Endgame, but that's it.
The only thing I can think of are the Godzilla movies from the 2000s.
Oh, yeah.
When Toho had this brilliant idea of, like, each movie will have its own continuity and its own timeline and its own history, and, like, they won't be connected. And it's like, that's a terrible way of doing things.
Yeah. Yeah. And those are, what's crazy is a lot of those movies are a lot of fun, but it's kind of like, why couldn't you work a little harder to go ahead and make this a follow up to the one previous, you know, it's just,
and then when it also reached that point where, like, all right, every movie must have Mothra.
Yeah. And they were all direct sequels, you know, to the first movie. The first movie, it seems like you can go through the entire history of Godzilla, and the one thing that is unmoving is the fact that the first movie always takes place, and then every other movie, whether it's a sequel to a previous sequel or not, it always references the first movie, or the first movie always happened until Shin Godzilla, which just came out. Actually, it seems like that's the first one that completely wipes away the first one off, you know, off the books, as it were.
Yeah, well, because the Shin Godzilla, having seen it, is basically just a modern day remake. It's been updated. Yeah, the first, I think about the first four Godzilla movies kind of tie in, because the end, the beginning of the second Godzilla movie ties in, has a little bit of tie to the first movie, and that, like, oh, there's another Godzilla. And then that one ends with Godzilla being buried in ice, which he then got out of at the beginning of King Kong versus Godzilla. And then he just kind of vanished into the ocean at the end of that movie, and then just magically appears, having been washed ashore and buried underneath the sand in a hurricane at the beginning of Godzilla versus Mothra. So they did try to have their own little continuity for a while there.
Yeah, I caught Shin Godzilla last week and wound up enjoying it quite a bit. Have you seen it yet? You have seen it. I've seen your tweets. I think my favorite is Shin Halloween. But
oh yes, I've been doing my running jokes about varying other Shin movies that they could make now. Because I mean, I enjoyed Shin Godzilla, but I completely understand why some people don't like it.
Oh, totally.
Because it's a weird movie and it's extremely talky. And it's basically, as I described, it should be called Destroy All Bureaucracy.
Yeah,
let me just say real quick, my phone has finally figured out how to stop incorrectly auto-correcting the word bureaucracy. when I first tweeted out that I had reviewed it for Dread Central, I added the joke, you know, Destroy All Bureaucracy, and didn't even realize, like, wait, that completely B-E-U-O-R-C-R-A-C-Y-C is like, that's not even close to being, I didn't even realize my phone had done that. It's like, oh great, that's been up for days now. It's like, and then I tried typing it again and like, yep, my phone keeps incorrectly, I've never seen that before. Like, it's changing the word to a word that doesn't exist.
Yeah, I don't know why I love Shin Godzilla, but I really did. It was great seeing it on the big screen. You know, I caught it at a local theater, you know, due to like it being a Fathom event or whatever. And I was watching it with a pretty big audience. And I swear, like, I could kind of feel people shifting in their seats by about the 30-minute mark when you hadn't seen much Godzilla by that point, but a whole lot of people talking. But for some reason, the fact that it was such a different approach to that story, I kind of dug it. But I have enjoyed the hell out of your tweets, like, reimagining various franchises and what it...
Well, real quick, before on Shin Godzilla, the one part where it kind of started to lose me a little bit with the talking was after Godzilla has that epic scene of destruction with his beam. Had what could be the single greatest Godzilla destruction sequence ever seen in a Godzilla movie, and you go immediately to another 30 minutes of, like, bureaucracy and scientific talk, and it's like, that wasn't quite the right approach. And then that bizarre ending where they're defeating Godzilla by tripping him and shoving shit in his mouth.
Okay, yeah, that was silly. I was just like, was that really their plan? Like, I thought they were going to inject him, which would have made more sense, I think. But no, it's like, we need to knock him down, we need to hope his mouth is open, and we need to just drive these trucks up and pour the shit in.
It looked like they were trying to do dental work on him. It's like, all right, Godzilla. It's like, if you reimagine the movie, Godzilla has a cavity, and he's really pissed off. So they figure the only thing they have to, like, give him a root canal, but he won't, like, stay still long enough for him to do it. So let's, like, fill trains with explosives and trip him and knock skyscrapers over and bury him temporarily, and then we'll quickly come up and ultra bright his teeth.
I would watch that movie too.
But that's what, I started, like, making jokes about, like, you know, Shin Halloween, where Michael Myers is killing people in Haddonfield while Dr. Loomis is stuck in a meeting at the asylum over protocols for how to prevent future escapees, you know, stuff like that. It's like, you know, Shin Friday the 13th, Jason's murdering camp counselors, but they're more focused on teaching the kids how to swim.
Okay, like, real quick, no preparation whatsoever. Can you do this? You ready?
Okay. All right.
Shin Werewolf of Woodstock.
Shin Werewolf of Woodstock. An electric werewolf is on the prowl, killing people, killing hippies, while the cops are more concerned with their latest Italian cooking experiment. That would really be it. They would just be sitting in sitting around, like, all right, what if we put some of the garlic or the barley and maybe some rotini? And meanwhile, there's, like, a werewolf murdering people in the background, and they're not even concerned at all. Like, that's all it is. It's like, It's like I said before, it's like, you know, a cooking show that's taking place where they're hosting a werewolf movie.
You know, I said I didn't want to see a remake, but that might have convinced me. I think that one might need to exist.
Yeah, you know, now that I think about it, you know, talking about, you know, the weirdness of Shin Godzilla real quick, here's another obscurity from Japan that's never been released in the U.S. A Toho movie that was made specifically for, like, preschool children called Daigoro versus Goliath.
The hell?
Yeah, it's another one you'd have to go, like, searching for the underground market probably to find. But it's the Japanese military killed this Godzilla-type monster, but it was a mom. And now they've kind of adopted the baby, which looks like this weird-looking hippo-type creature that should be on some sort of children's, like a Yo Gabba Gabba-type show. but then this other, like horned reptilian monster shows up and starts, you know, trashing the place. So they want to, like, train the Daigoro creature to actually, like, be a protector, but it's kind of a coward. And it's a very, very odd kids movie. It doesn't have a whole lot of monster action in it, but it I believe it's the only monster movie that ever ends with teaching a monster, where basically the big ending is not Daigoro, you know, overcoming, you know, karate kidding Goliath and saving Japan. No, the big ending is they potty train the monster. They have a giant porta potty on the island, and it comes out having gone to the potty by itself for the first time, and everyone celebrates.
And then they fix his teeth.
Cool. Then they trip. Yeah, there you go. You go to the new restaurant, the Shin Steakhouse, where they, like, trip you and then just start shoving steak in your mouth.
It's amazing to me, like the wide world of obscure movies that's kind of out there. You know, I like to think of myself as maybe a kind of sort of knowledgeable film fan at times, sometimes. But, you know, I it's always fun to hear about movies or to watch movies that I never knew existed or even could exist. And I think The Werewolf of Woodstock definitely is that. So, but sir, I think we pretty much reached about the end of our time. Can I ask, where can fans find you at on Twitter? Where can people bother you for obscure movie recommendations?
Foy Wonder on Twitter is probably the one. And, I still do occasional reviews and news for Dredge Central. You'll find me on there sometimes. And if you seek out my Foy Wonder YouTube channel, you will find all sorts of weirdness. Clips from movies, clips from TV show. Another hobby, a passion of mine, has been failed television pilots. Oh. TV shows that where they made the pilot, but it didn't get on the air. I became enamored with that a couple of years ago after they ran this TV special where they were just showing clips from some of these things. It was a whole show about, like, failed TV pilots. So I had to go seek some of these things out, and I've got clips from some of them on YouTube. So that'll blow your mind. Like, for example, Samurai, starring Joe Penny as Japanese American lawyer / samurai vigilante. Who Sold. Is the most Italian looking Japanese American you'll ever see? who doesn't wear any kind of mask, yet nobody seems to recognize him, even though he's a well known lawyer in San Francisco. And then he proceeds to use his samurai sword for everything except actually stabbing or cutting someone, because, you know, they didn't want to make it too violent. But then, just because you didn't think this was weird enough, the villain is a real estate mogul who is trying to get these people to, like, he's basically, like, you know, using any means necessary to get people to sell him this property. And if they refuse to sell, he just, you know, does something really violent to them. And when that doesn't work, he busts out an earthquake machine. Yes, he has an earthquake machine that he will just use and take down your building, which samurai ends up carjacking and then drives it right through the front of the guy's office's building. His skyscraper, and then turns it on and nearly topples the skyscraper, and then they arrest the bad guys.
And the networks didn't go for this.
Somehow this did not become a TV show. So there you go.
Cool. Hey, thank you so much for being on. I really appreciate your time, and I appreciate your choosing such a cool, obscure little movie as The Werewolf of Woodstock. I had a lot of fun watching it, and I hopefully our listeners can track it down, because I just checked YouTube, and unfortunately, it looks like only a couple of clips are up from it. So
I'm kind of shocked. maybe the Dick Clark estate pulled the plug on it.
Well, if you can't find it, folks, definitely make certain to try and seek it out and check it out, because it is a lot of fun. And as always, thanks for listening. Make certain to like, subscribe, share, use the comment section below. Check out our YouTube show. We still have that deal for you through Audible. Sign up for a free 30-day trial and get 2 free books. Thanks so much, gang. We'll see you next time.
And it appears to this reporter that it's going to take a lot more than good vibrations to get things back to normal. But for the time being, the beat still goes on.